Well, isn't uncertainty a killer? Will the electricity come back on today, or tomorrow, or the day after, or several days after that? Should I leave everything in the freezer and keep the door shut in the hope that it does come on soon, or should I get some ice, get a generator? Should I put the most expensive stuff, or the stuff that goes off badly, in the camping fridge? What should I do? On Thursday morning, we had Weet-Bix topped with runny ice cream. It was a good use of ice cream that was rapidly going soft. We just got the news right that the power might not come back on until Saturday, and the ice cream was not going to last that long. Uncertainty is hard, right? It's got some benefits, but it's hard. From the trivial, right, to the unimportant. How much super do I need to accumulate? Because how long am I going to live? Should I downsize? Where should I downsize? What subjects should I study? Because I really don't know what I want to do. Should I go out with my friends right now or later on? What's the best offer? What car should I buy? Who should I date? Who should I marry? Should I remarry? But what if? What if this happens? What if that happens? Uncertainty is hard. And I wonder, what decisions would we make differently if we actually had more certainty? If we knew the power was coming back on when it actually was, what would we have done differently? And if you had certainty, what would you have done differently? Not just with the power, but everything else. Imagine if you had known what was going to happen and what was needed to be done. Uncertainty is a killer, isn't it? It paralyzes us. It confuses us, and it causes us to make decisions that we really don't feel equipped to do. And to make decisions that turn out sometimes not so good. It's one thing getting certainty from the electricity company, right? But it's another thing to get certainty from God. Have you ever wished that God would tell you just exactly what was going to happen and exactly what you should do? But normally that's not how God works, is it? God doesn't micromanage us. He gave us options, choices, decisions to make. And as people created in the image of God, just as he created Adam and Eve in his image, Genesis 1:26, God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule." So that they may rule. You see, ruling our world is what humans do because they're in the image of God. And ruling our world involves making choices and taking risks and making decisions in the own little bit of our world that we're in charge of, that we have influence over. And remember Paul's prayer from Philippians chapter 1 last week? Philippians chapter 1 verse 9, "And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best, and may be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ." See, what does he pray? For more love, more knowledge, depth of insight, so that they could work out what is best to do and so live good lives for Jesus. You see, we've got choices to make, wisdom to work on, uncertainty to deal with, but God doesn't leave us without hope. He gives us a way to live, even though he doesn't give us the detail of exactly what we need to do. And so let's look at the final verse of chapter 1 of Philippians, chapter 1, verses 27 and 28. "Whatever happens," this is verse 27 and 28, "conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in the one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you." First two words, whatever happens. Whatever happens. Because we don't know what will happen. And the Apostle Paul didn't know what would happen, and they don't know what will happen. God hasn't promised that it will be clear to them. We don't know what will happen. Whatever happens, though, we want to do well. And whatever happens, he wanted them to do well. Could I have that photo up, please, on the screen? There we go. Here you go. This is an old photo of the Christian group I was with at uni 25 years ago. Okay, some of the people in that photo have gotten a bit older, a bit fatter, a bit balder. Mel still looks the same. But you look at the clothes and the hair, you see things change in 25 years. As far as I know, some of these people are not active Christians. At least one of them has died. Some of them are actively involved in their churches. Some are married, some are single, some have families that they care for. Next photo. All right, here's a photo from 35 years ago of this church, standing where you're sitting right now. The kids would probably be my age now, I think. Many of them would have passed away. One day, this will be us. People will look back at this time and wonder what we did with the rest of our lives. Could you click onto the blank for me? Thank you. What we want is people who, whatever happens, live in a way that is worthy of Christ. 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 6 years, even 90 years left for some of you here, Lord willing. Whatever happens, we want to live in a manner that is worthy of the gospel for the rest of our lives. Whatever happens, whatever. Regardless of if this happens or that happens, if your business collapses, you fail your course, your father dies, your mother dies, your fiance dies, whatever happens, you know, your husband leaves you, your girlfriend dumps you, your business fails, your parents stop paying for you, whatever happens. You're ugly, you're awkward, you have no friends, whatever happens. You have mental health issues, you have chronic health issues, whatever it is. Your husband dies, your wife dies, your child dies, or you can't have kids. You see, whatever happens. Your church is annoying, your pastor fails, you're prosecuted for religious discrimination, whatever happens. Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. See, there's no exclusions, no exceptions, no reasons to ever live in a manner that's not worthy of the gospel of Christ, because it's whatever happens. Even when things are uncertain. We want to be unashamed. That's what we want. Not embarrassed, whether private or public, wherever, whenever, whatever happens, unashamed. We do need a new church photo. But I did put one in from the service from last year. Let's see that one. Is it there? Nope, it's not there. Deleted. Technology issues. We're going to be different. We're going to look back at ourselves 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, whatever it is. I hope we can dig up a photo, laugh at our clothes, whatever it happens to be. But I hope that we can look back and go through the people in that photo and say, look, they're unashamed of the gospel. And we go, oh, they've moved away, but they're living for Jesus, and he's living for Jesus, and she's living for Jesus. And my, look at how much little Johnny's grown. And he's living for Jesus. Standing firm in one spirit, contending, fighting for the faith of the gospel. We don't want to hear news about us fighting each other. Remember Philippians 1, we're partners in good news, same goal, same spirit, without rivalry, without selfishness. And see here, the one focus and goal of this community that are partners in the good news should be in the faith of the gospel. The faith of the gospel, the faith that Jesus has given out, partners in the good news. So whatever happens, and now into chapter 2, we need to get the right attitude. The right attitude. And I'm sure some of you have met talented people who are a total waste of time at work. Not because they don't know anything, they know an awful lot. But because they've got a terrible attitude. We need the same attitude as Jesus. Chapter 2, verse 2, make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. like-minded. Like-minded with Jesus and with Paul and with the other Christians. Like-minded, he says, and love each other. Do nothing, verse 3, out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. Looking out for the interests of others. I think these short verses could really change our whole lives. This attitude, the attitude of Jesus, is life-changing. It's world-shattering, really. It's a way of thinking and a way of living that makes your life worth something to the people around you. Looking out for others, prioritizing their needs, making sure that they do well. Because that's what Jesus did. Listen to what Jesus did, and it's easy for us to skip past these verses of what he did and just think we're all on our own. But listen to what Jesus did. Verse 6, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. So he looks after others, even those who are his enemies. He models how the world should change because he makes that change happen. It's kind of like Jesus in customer service, and he's caring for all the people out there rather than himself. And as we copy him, we become the change that he wants. And so here are a few implications just within our church family, right? If this church is unfriendly, it's an opportunity to start being friendly, to make that change happen. If this church is unwelcoming, it's a chance to start welcoming. If no one looks out for you, it creates a space for you to start looking out for others. If we don't do enough, you could do something better. If we ought to do music better or Sunday school better or sausage sizzles better or praying better or whatever it happens to be, there's a chance to volunteer, to make a difference. Because as you look out for the interests of others, you do what Jesus did, who looks out for other people. What happens to people who live like this? Because sometimes it feels like there's nothing in it for you, right? What happens to people who care for others before themselves? It's a bit of a hint. We get what Jesus gets. In verse 9 to 11, therefore God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. You see, as Jesus is exalted, we get to share with him. We get to share with him. You see, when Jesus is revealed as the true owner of the world, the Lord, each of us will bow. Some of us will bow with joy. Some of us will bow with hatred. But make no mistake, all of us will bow. Each of us will submit to him, willingly or unwillingly. That Jesus Christ is God. And so if you want to make a life that's worth something now, if you want to make a difference now, if you want to have meaning and purpose now, you need the same attitude as Jesus now. Otherwise, it's going to be too hard to live like him. You can try and do all the stuff, but if you don't trust him, you won't be able to do it. Whatever happens, we need to live obediently before God. Verses 12 to 18. And it doesn't tell us exactly what this means. It doesn't kind of lay out exactly what you must do each and every time. But basically, it's about doing the stuff that Jesus says. You know, being honest, keeping our word, being sexually pure, being generous, being loving, doing what's right, even when it's not popular. And he doesn't detail each single thing you should do in every instance, but he gives you the principle of how to live. Verse 12, therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. It's a sort of lifestyle that's going to require discipline. And that can be hard. It's going to require obedience to Jesus. But if Jesus is who he claims to be, the one who is exalted as Lord, as boss of this world, then it's going to be worth it. It's going to be worth practicing it. Or as these verses put it, it's worth doing. What is it? Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Put your salvation into practice. Keep working hard at living obediently. Why fear? Because Jesus is greater than anyone and anything. And the consequences are huge if you get it wrong. And that's scary. It's like there's a big tree down across the power lines. I actually had to drive through Merbau North on Wednesday morning, and it was a mess. And there's a tree leaning on the power lines. Should you fear it? It's dangerous. If you get it wrong, someone could die. Jesus is more powerful than anyone or anything. And with that power comes appropriate fear and trembling before him. It's right to approach power with fear. It's right to recognize his position and hold that truth, even as we remember that we're united to him by his Spirit and he loves us and he's committed to our good. As we remember that we share his resurrection and his resurrection power. Now we want to remember that we don't earn our salvation or God's favor by our obedience. God doesn't love you more because you do the right thing. You don't obtain your salvation through obedience or through fear and trembling. But obedience is something that Christians do after they are saved by God. You see, you put your salvation to work. You give it some exercise. You don't expect someone who's not a Christian to be obedient to Jesus. But after someone becomes a Christian, it's natural that they want to obey. You can think of it a bit like a job, right? You're employed by Macca's, okay, by McDonald's. You don't know anything about flipping burgers when you get the job. You don't know anything about fries. You don't know anything about timers and beepers and whatever is going on in those crazy kitchens. But you work it out. You learn on the job. And that's how Christians do it. Jesus saves you and then you learn on the job. You work out your job description. You quite possibly do it with fear and trembling because you know you don't know what to do. You want to make it through the probationary period at least, right? You don't know the job. Salvation is something like employment. You get given a job, salvation, without any experience. And you are saved without any experience. You don't know what it is to be saved until you're saved. You don't know how to live until you're saved. In fact, all the experience you got before you're saved is actually unhelpful for obedience to Jesus afterward. You see, everything you've learnt is kind of wrong. You start working it out. You start adopting the attitude of the company that you work for and that you love. You start copying what they do and you try and do it better and better. You do it when you're saved, not before. You start copying Jesus. And verse 14, here's something we probably all find hard. Verse 14, do everything without grumbling or arguing. See, I think complaining and arguing is probably a national sport. If there was an Olympics, I'm sure we'd all do well. And Christians are good at it, and I'm good at it. But here's the thing, if you want to make a difference in your home, in your church, in your workplace, Jesus says do it without grumbling and complaining because you can actually put your trust in me and know that it's under control and looked after. What's the consequence? Verse 15, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation, then you will shine among them like stars in the sky. Quit grumbling and complaining. It's your chance to shine for Jesus. And the way you do that, verse 16, it's by holding firmly onto the word of life. You see, if you just tell yourself, stop grumbling and complaining, it's probably not going to work. But as you hold firmly to the word of life, the good news of Jesus, you see, if you want to shine, hold on to the good words of Jesus. And so as a church, we need to hold on to the words of Jesus as our top priority. You see, the words of Jesus beat fancy programs and fancy graphics. The words of Jesus beat projectors that, you know, keep stopping in the middle of a song. The words of Jesus beat the best welcoming team in the world. And we will succeed by holding firmly onto the words of Jesus. And here, when it talks about holding onto those words, it probably doesn't actually mean evangelism. It's actually about holding onto it personally by reading, listening, speaking on our own and together. And by holding onto the good news and living according to the good news, that's us working out our salvation. You see, we get to apply the theory. You are, according to verse 15, living like someone blameless and pure, like a true child of God, like a little star in a dark world. Paul was in prison when he writes this, but he's not complaining. So we need to be like Paul, not complaining about his job, verse 17. He is glad, he rejoices, like Jesus. And so whatever happens, we need to be like that and be like these other people in verses 19 to 30, who we're just going to look at quickly. He wants us, whatever happens, to copy them. I don't know if you noticed when we were reading, but there's kind of this abrupt break in verse 19. You've kind of got all this really deep, heavy theology, right? Every knee will bow, every tongue confess, and all this stuff about Jesus. And then he starts talking about himself and his mates, Timothy and Epaphroditus. And you've got to kind of ask, why did he do this? Did he just kind of, he gone, all right, I'm too intense, I've got to take it easy for a bit now. Well, I think what's happening, because in chapter 3, by the way, he's going to go on to more deep stuff again. But why start talking about them? And I think it is, he says, just as Jesus modeled how to live, and I've talked about him, there are some other models to follow as well. Jesus was around a long time ago. But Timothy and Epaphroditus, they're here right now. And so if you want to know someone to copy, well, they're copying Jesus, you copy them. Okay? Because you get to know the sorts of things they do. You get to see how they do things when they're disappointed. You get to see if they grumble and complain. You get to see if they rejoice. And so copy them. Timothy, he's in verse 19. What does he do? He takes a genuine interest in your welfare. Unlike, verse 21, everyone else who's busy thinking about themselves. There's Epaphroditus, verse 25. He's concerned for them as well. And Paul wants to send him off to them so they're comforted. And then you've got Paul himself. What does Paul do? The two guys who are helping him, he wants to get rid of them so that they're good for other people. When I say get rid of, he wants to send them away so that they could actually serve others instead of him. They're working out their salvation and they're worth copying. Now that was even a longer time ago, right? And so to you who have been Christians for a long time, don't stop. Keep working out your salvation with fear and trembling, because you answer to Jesus. And if you're a bad example, if you're like a lazy employee, you're corrupting the newer Christians who look to you as if you're Jesus, because you're in between Jesus and them as an example. People copy you. Old Christian, young Christian, whatever it is, but imagine this. If the whole church was like you, what would the church be like? Would it be a good place, or would it be a horror? Would it have people loving and serving, or would it be a place where just people weren't really looked after? Please, make it so that if we were to look around and someone says, I don't know who to copy, I don't know who to follow, Jesus was a long time ago, we could kind of just randomly open our eyes and point and go, copy Fred as he copies Christ. Copy Mary as she copies Christ. Copy Shelley, copy James. Be like these people. People who love and serve and go out of their way to look after others just like Jesus did. Now, this is my opinion. I have a suspicion that COVID has made us more selfish. We've become less like Jesus, and that we've become more concerned with ourselves and less concerned about other people. We've kind of spent a whole lot of time protecting ourselves, and we've forgotten that working out our salvation means being like Jesus, like Paul, like Timothy, and going out of our way to serve others. It's appropriate to look after your health and to take proper precautions and all those sorts of things, right? But I wonder if we've extended it into every sphere of life. Jesus served and saved the world. And we can serve and shine like a star in a dark world as we copy him. So whatever happens, Paul pleads with you and I plead with you. Live lives worthy of the gospel of Christ. It might sound hard, but we've got the example of Jesus. And remember this, God has not abandoned you. See, as you take on the attitude of Christ, as you're like-minded, as you have the same love, as you're one in spirit and purpose, as you look out for the interests of others, you are obedient to God, and God is working through you. Chapter 2, 13, it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose. God will be working through you. In your family, in your workplace, in your school, in your travel, in your sports, in your friendship groups, God works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. You see, you can be the change that Jesus wants to see happen in the world, and you can be unashamed. You can live and be a shining star in a dark place, and it can be really dark. See, things are not as uncertain as we thought. Imagine if you have certainty. But here it is, Jesus will return. He will return in glory. God has exalted him to the highest place, and his followers will share his glory. He promises wisdom for those who ask. Wisdom to know how to live in a dark and confusing place. And he's given us people to copy. We want to be unashamed, and in 15 20, 40 years' time, if I've got that many. I want to look back and see that the gospel that's been preached to you through many other people and me has not been a waste of time, and that your lives have not been wasted because you have taken the same attitude as Jesus, the same sort of love, the same sort of care, the same sort of value of others, and you have changed the world, maybe just one life at a time. Not big, but just those few people that are around you as you put their needs above yours, as you do what Jesus did. And there on that final day, when each of us bows the knee to Jesus, you'll be there happily, and you will shout with the people from all around the world of every time and place that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And then as you look around, you will see gathered there with you the people you loved and served and gave up your time for, also worshipping him joyfully. What a great end. Let's pray.